Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kona e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
I don't believe that the crooks that did it realised exactly how much they got away with. And when they would have realised, you know, they would have known that getting away with a couple of hundred pounds or a couple of thousand pounds would be forgotten. But to get away with that much, you know, they were going to get caught. No one was going to forget that.
Hi, I'm Jesse Mulligan and you're listening to Crimes NZ. It's a podcast where I talk to people connected in some way or another with New Zealand's most serious crimes. In this episode, true crime writer Scott Bainbridge takes us back to 1956 when Auckland mobsters made off with the equivalent of $1 million in today's money after breaking into the Waterfront Industry Commission's offices. It's one of the most brazen robberies in New Zealand history.
Yeah, look, in the 1950s, a lot of the crime that was going on was the safe breaking. The guys would break into businesses or factories and blow the safes and would make off with whatever money they could. The old sort of aggravated robberies, you know, of banks and such, like, didn't sort of start occurring till the late 1960s. So a lot of the crime that was committed back then, you know, was done in darkness, and nobody was being heard apart from the people that lost all their money.
Yeah, and who was doing the crime? Can you give us a bit of a description of this New Zealand underbelly of the mid-century?
Yeah, look, I think a lot of the media over the years have sort of played out these guys to be sort of big, tough, sort of, you know, violent gangsters when, I think back in the 50s and 60s, I've heard that you could just come to Auckland or whatever place you wanted to go, get off the bus, and by the end of the day, you had a job. So there were jobs for everybody. But these were guys that didn't want to work and just wanted the easy lifestyle, and they had particular skills. If you wanted, for instance, to break in and blow up a safe and you were involved on the fringes of the crime scene, you'd know guys that, you know, had a particular skill, whether it was blowing up a safe or doing a soup job, which was the, you know, the old mobster term for cutting open a safe by using oxygen and acetylene, you know, just sort of burning off the top of the safe and opening it up so it would be like, it would resemble a soup can, and just sort of taking off the money. So, you know, there were people with particular skills.
Yeah, to coin a phrase. And who were some of these people?
It was a reasonably small element of people, and a lot of the research I've done with the two books I've written about this, of the old gangster scene of Auckland, have basically been centred in Auckland. And the first book I did, which was about the Bassett Road machine gun murders, that covered a whole range of, you know, different crooks. When I came to do the prequel to that, which obviously came out later, which is about the Waterfront Payroll robbery, I found during the research that the same names that kept appearing, you know, the same guys that, you know, that would be found in the sly grogs and, you know, that would be arrested for whatever crimes. So there was a reasonably small percentage of guys and women as well in Auckland at that time that, and they all knew each other, they all associated with one another. And one thing I did learn is that, you know, a lot of the jobs, the criminal jobs, were actually planned and organised at the various sly grogs, the illegal sly grogs. So this is the era of 6 o'clock closing, where you couldn't get a drink after 6 o'clock. So some enterprising individuals, you know, usually operated on the fringes of the crime world, would open up their homes at night and sell beer and watered down rum, etc. And these were sort of found, you know, scattered around Auckland, but also in other cities around the country. And crooks would associate themselves with a particular beer house. So you might have a favoured beer house that you'd go to, and there'd be a guy here that you might have committed a job with. And, you know, and if you wanted to go and commit another crime somewhere else, but you heard sort of through the grapevine that John down the road, he goes to another beer house, you know, you could link up with him. But attached to a lot of these beer houses were, because there was gambling, such as the Crown and Anchor games and the two-up, which was usually run by some of the crooks, and some of them would carry a two-headed coin for the two-up game. You know, so that the house was always going to win. But there were like private madams who would associate themselves with a particular beer house. So if you wanted to go, and a lot of the patrons who usually frequented the beer houses were sailors, you know, off the boat would come in after 6 o'clock. There's nowhere to get a drink or a girl. And so they'd go to a beer house and, you know, the madams would send the girls down and charge £5 for their services. And the beer house would get, or the slog rock would get a cut of that.
Who was the ringleader of the sort of mob scene in Auckland? Any famous names at the time?
There weren't any kingpins, but Archie Banks was probably the one that was mostly connected with a lot of the beer houses and knew a lot of the crooks, and also knew a lot of the crimes that were going down, and also knew, you know, where the best places were to go. And so Archie Banks himself, he had blown up some safes. And when I interviewed his son, John Banks, John was... found himself an unwittingly getaway driver when his dad went down to, you know, to get some meat from a warehouse, and it was in the middle of the night, and the glass front of the meat factory blew out onto the road, and his dad was running up the road with all the spent money in the satchel, you know. So
this is not the John Banks I wanted to clarify.
Yes, it is the John Banks.
Yeah. Is it?
Yeah. So his dad was, Archie was, pretty well connected with a lot of the crime. And I remember when I interviewed John, you know, I remember him saying that his dad was, you know, really nice. He'd be, he'd shake your hand and introduce himself and be really nice. But in his mind, he'd be thinking about ways in which he could rip you off.
So, and wasn't thinking that his son would one day be the Minister of Police, no doubt.
Well, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Tell us about this waterfront payroll robbery then. Where did this fit in? What happened?
Well, the Waterfront Industry Commission was that was the organisation that paid all the cargo workers. So, you know, the number of cargo workers or wharfside workers, there were thousands around the country. And so the offices of the Auckland Waterfront Industry Commission was situated across the road in the Northern Steamship Company building, which today still exists. It's a heritage building. It's a pub now. And so the night before payday, which was obviously going to be a huge payroll, some guys broke into it and tried to blow up the safe. And when they found it was unsuccessful, it was the type of safe that couldn't be blown up, you know, for whatever reason, the way it was made. And so they went away and they got someone with the skills to do a soup job, and they burned open the top of the safe and took, the equivalent of close to $1 million in today's money. And it was the amount of money that no one in the years since, up until sort of the beginning of this century, have replicated. So it was a huge sum of money. And I don't believe that the crooks that did it realised exactly how much they got away with. And when they would have realised, you know, they would have known that getting away with a couple of £100 or a couple of £1,000 would be forgotten. But to get away with that much, you know, they were going to get caught. No one was going to forget that. And it had a huge political ramification as well, because Mr. Bockett, who was the president of the Waterfront Industry Commission, also assisted the government 5 years earlier with the on the waterfront strikes. And it was a really controversial time. And his contact was John Marshall, who later became Prime Minister. And John Marshall, if you have read some of the other history books out there, he was the Minister of Justice at that time. And he was, they called him sort of the hanging judge, because, you know, he was responsible for, you know, signing the hanging notices on a number of guys who you know, that committed murder but may have got off on, you know, in today's legalities. So John Marshall sort of implored the police to keep going, but, you know, they couldn't find anybody for it. And then sort of over a year and a half later, there was a petty criminal called Trevor Nash, who was going from shop to shop tendering £10 notes. And sort of back then, £10 was worth $500 today. So what he was doing is going into a dairy and buying, say, you know, a newspaper and giving, you know, £10 for it. And he was going from shop to shop doing this, making little purchases. This is his way of laundering the money. But, you know, it was a Friday morning and a lot of the shop assistants were having to rush off to the bank to get change because they didn't have change. And so as they're all passing each other in the street before morning tea, saying, oh, we've had this guy come and giving it a £10 note, and found it was a... So the police were alerted and they caught up with him, and they found a car full of ballpoint pens and newspapers and magazines and a small sum of money. When they arrested Trevor Nash, he was never on their radar, but, you know, found out later that Trevor was a type of guy that could, A, blow up a safe, and he could also, he was one of about five crooks, I think, that could, in that time, that could do a soup job. So he was arrested and charged and got the maximum term imprisonment, which was then 7 years. But a couple of years into his sentence, on a Friday afternoon, he escaped from Mount Eden prison. And how that happened,
amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, it was just amazing because Trevor never mentioned anything to anybody about you know, who else was on the job. And yeah, he went to, he eventually sort of, I think, knew that he wasn't going to get anywhere with the authorities, and so he managed to secure himself a job in one of the workshops in the prison yard. And on this particular Friday afternoon in 1961, he would make excuses with his job to sort of, you know, go out of the shed, and then he'd come back. And what he was actually doing was he managed to acquire some tin snips, and he was going to the perimeter and just, you know, cutting a few pieces of the fence away. And then just after 3 o'clock, he never came back. And as I say, it was a Friday afternoon. It was the second Friday of the month. And at that particular time every month, the prison sounded the escape alarm just to practice, you know, just as a test. And so when they sounded it for real that afternoon, no one really, you know, the police didn't really sort of do anything about it because they wow. thought it was just another test. And then it was, and I know that this would have been out of Trevor's control, but by the time the, you know, the police did eventually turn up about an hour later, it just bucketed down with rain. And so the police dog couldn't get a scent. And so, you know, he made away with it. And his, you know, probably his escape was captured more headlines than the robbery itself, because there were people were encouraged to, you know, be on the lookout. And in fact, I say in the book, The Great New Zealand Robbery, that there was one poor guy from Australia who just arrived in the country about a week later, and he had the misfortune of looking like Trevor Nash, and he was arrested 3 times in 1 week, you know, because people thought it was him. And so in the end, he got back on the boat and went back to Australia, vowing never to return. But yeah, Trevor remained on the run for about 7 months, and then, and again, purely coincidentally, he managed to make his way over to Melbourne, and there was a detective in Melbourne who, when Trevor escaped in the February, the Talex machine sort of burst into life over in Melbourne, and of an escaped criminal, you know, be on the lookout in case he shows up. Well, 7 months later, this detective sees, you know, Trevor at a cafe in Melbourne and said, I think that's the guy that escaped from New Zealand, you know, 7 months ago, and arrested him on the spot. So, I mean, that was remarkable in itself. This guy had a photographic memory, and Trevor sort of was extradited back to New Zealand.
Sounds like a bit of a character, old Trevor. Did he ever talk about the robbery and whether he was, in fact, the person responsible?
I never met Trevor. He passed away sort of in the early 2000s, but I managed to track down some of the guys that, you know, worked with him on some of the jobs. And in fact, I managed to track down an old crook who, you know, he admitted to me that he worked in a shop next door at Mount Eden and gave Trevor the tin snips in which, you know, he could cut his way out. But the few people that do that I, you know, did talk to, one of the family members I talked to, you know, recalled, you know, inviting Trevor to his wedding, and, you know, Trevor made off with some of the wedding presents, you know, later on that night. So he was that type of character, probably in the same vein as Archie Banks. He'd be looking, you know, in a way to rip you off. I had a great deal of trouble tracking down immediate family members of Trevor, but I did after the book came out, unfortunately, and I had a good chat with them. And, you know, they're of the opinion that Trevor committed the robbery by himself, because he was the type of guy that was, you know, quite selfish, and he would very much keep to himself. He was very much a loner. However, I was lucky when I did the research for this book, The Great New Zealand Robbery, is that I had access, I was able to get access, thanks to the Police National Headquarters, to the actual files. And there's evidence or there's detail in there to suggest that it was more than, you know, a one-man job. And I do say that in my book, that there was five, if not six, people involved, without obviously giving too much of the game away. But there were definitely two men that were involved from the outset, and they tried to blow up the safe. And when they realised they couldn't, they had to go off searching for somebody who could, and that's where I suggest that perhaps Trevor, being one of five guys in Auckland that could do a soup job, you know, they corralled him to come and do it. And also, I believe it was an inside job, that there's somebody that actually worked at the Industry Commission building may have given them the tip-off that, you know, a Tuesday night was the right, you know, best night to go and rob it. There was obviously a getaway driver, because he was a car that was seen speeding away. And also, the waterfront itself used to employ retired old sailors to, you know, wander the Quay Street and Custom Street, you know, act as security guards for anybody trying to sneak onto the wharves. So there was one older guy that was, you know, patrolling that particular area, and when, you know, they talked to him, you know, he said he didn't see a thing. However, they found out later that, you know, he was associated with, you know, some of the other, you know, safe blowers that used to drink at one of the notorious pubs there in Auckland.
Yeah. What an amazing era. Did everyone sort of eventually grow out of it? I mean, I imagine there were cops and mobsters at the time who knew each other pretty well, but they would have grown old together, would they?
Yeah, they did. And one of the detectives would say that, you know, if there was a big job that went down on a particular weekend, they'd phone or go and visit all of the sly grogs to find out, you know, who was the big spenders on the weekend. And that's usually how they got the crooks. I know that I had my book launch for the Great New Zealand Robbery in the Northern Steamship Company building where the robbery took place. And I invited a number of, you know, the retired detectives that were involved with the consorting squad in the 1960s. And I remember one of them, you know, coming up to me, and they brought along an elderly chap and introduced me. And they said, "Oh, this is Johnny. I arrested him, you know, years ago for blowing up a couple of safes, you know, five safes or something like that." And Johnny sort of looked at him and goes, "Yeah, but you didn't arrest me for, you know, about 15 other jobs I did." And it cracked me up. And you know, there's a group of retired detectives and a group of old crooks, you know, that, you know, they do get together, you know, every so often and have a chinwag about the good old days, which I think is quite nice. And, you know, it'd be hard to fathom that the cops and the crooks, you know, of today would, you know, do that in 20, 30 years' yeah. time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. There are plenty more episodes on the RNZ Podcasts page, and you can find them on Apple, Spotify, iHeart, or wherever you get your favourite podcasts. If you're looking for something a little different, check out Our Changing World or Voices, two weekly podcasts that really get you thinking. Our Changing World tells stories from science and the environment, while Voices tells the stories of people from a diverse global background. Both programs air on my afternoon show on RNZ National.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.